Morning, stakeholders who are here to get a response from Treasury on the submissions that you have made. Good morning to the media, to the support teams from different departments in Parliament. You are all welcome, and also the public at large, you are welcome. The meeting is officially open. Are there apologies?
Mr. Skosana is attending the Section 194 committee. That's the only apology.
Okay. Let's note the apology of Mr. Skosana.
Chairperson, can we note that Honorable Sirupin has been delayed? He will be joining in the next few minutes.
Okay, Dr. George. Let's move to item two. I see that Pastor is here. Pastor Steve.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, colleagues. Thanks for the sitting. Looking forward to engaging with Treasury and other stakeholders. Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome, Pastor. Let's move to item two. The purpose of the meeting today is to get the response from National Treasury to submissions received in the general laws anti-money laundering and combating terrorism financing, Amendment Bill B18-2022. So after Treasury will have done the response, we're going to take comments from stakeholders. Each stakeholder will be allocated 3 minutes. Noxie, are you there? Because sometimes
yes, I'm here.
Yeah, in case nibene nengxaki ye load shedding or connectivity, you will come in.
Okay, sure.
Sure. Okay. Vukile, your team, or is the DG in the platform? Whosoever is leading the team from Treasury, can you lead in responding to the submissions received on the general laws amendment? Over to you.
Morning, Chair, and thank you again for the opportunity. We will be taking you through the responses to the comments and the additional comments as you set out the additional period for commentators to provide comments. Chair, I'm joined today as usual by our colleagues from the FIC, as well as a relatively large Treasury delegation. I will hand over, Chair, to Janine, who will take us through the comments and specific responses. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, and thank you again for the opportunity to meet on the General Laws Amendment Bill. And this presentation particularly focuses on the comments that were received subsequent to the initial set of comments that we responded to the last time in the previous meeting. So this presentation seeks to provide some feedback on the further comments that were received during the comments process. So this presentation focuses on 16 comments that were received in total by 25th of October. And the majority of comments, again, focused particularly on the amendments to the Nonprofit Organization Act. And a number of commentators requested a further extension of the comment period to afford the public who might not be aware of the implications of the bill an opportunity to comment. The majority of the commentators support the bill and its objectives in general, but have provided specific comments which will be highlighted in this presentation. And many of the comments have reiterated similar concerns that were indicated during the comments that were received in the first comment period. We would note that there were 10 comments that we received subsequently this presentation has not had an opportunity to fully provide a response to, and these submissions are those that are listed below. And we will provide detailed responses to those submissions in the next committee meeting, as we certainly want to thoroughly provide responses to all of the submissions received. So we just wanted to note that we will provide further responses on those particular comments. So one commentator was a report from Intellidex that was commissioned by Business Leadership South Africa on the likelihood and consequences of South Africa being grey listed. And this report appears to have been submitted primarily for information purposes, as it did not seem to raise specific issues in respect of provisions of the bill itself. Another comment was about the absence of a socioeconomic impact assessment, and it was noted that there is little to go on when it comes to evaluating whether legislation is beneficial or harmful, and it can only be speculated, you know, what the implications of the legislation might be. So we certainly note this comment, and generally, socioeconomic impact assessments are provided with all of the legislation. That's a cabinet requirement generally. But in this specific case, an exemption was granted due to the urgent consequences of cabinet meeting to approve and for the bill to be processed. Then another comment that was raised by stakeholders, and this was also a comment raised in the previous set of submissions, was relating to the transitional period. And it was highlighted that it's important that a sufficient transitional period be allowed for it relates to the implementation of the beneficial ownership requirements contemplated by the various pieces of legislation. And consideration should be given to providing for adequate transitional arrangements or a different effective date to be proclaimed to allow sufficient time for, amongst others, you know, all types of companies and all types of entities to be able to prepare for the implementation of the legislation. And then the third comment was that if the FIC Act and various pieces of legislation in their final form do indeed recreate a dependency on regulations prior to becoming effective and enforceable, sufficient lead time in the absence of transitional periods for consultation and implementation would be required to not automatically cause regulated entities to be non-compliant. We would note that in this case, a formal transitional period in the legislation is not feasible to be provided for due to the necessity of having all of the legislation in force for FATF to take the legislation into account when assessing progress in relation to compliance with the FATF requirements. And however, in respect of compliance with the obligations contained in discussions with relation to the FIC Act, discussions in the supervisory forum will take into account the approach to inspections and sanctioning with regard to the new obligations that have been provided for in the legislation to ensure harmonization of supervision of accountable supervisors. And a similar approach will be taken by other regulators who are responsible for the other pieces of legislation amended in this bill in respect of the obligations of the other acts that are being amended. And in relation to access to beneficial owner registers, while access through accountable institutions is supported, the consultations that will be held that will assist to finalize the final wording that will be included in the regulations dealing with access to beneficial ownership registers will be undertaken. And the regulators will assist accountable institutions to ensure that they receive necessary support to implement the new requirements before any enforcement action will be taken for non-compliance with the new obligation. And then finally, about with respect to the regulations, the regulations will be published for public comment prior to them being finally promulgated and brought into force. So there will be opportunity to comment on the content of the regulations. There was a comment that was made that perhaps the Trust Property Control Act in its entirety should be done away with, and rather everything, you know, every business owner or large conduit funder organization should be required to register with the CIPC. And then the view is that perhaps then you may not need to amend all of the other pieces of legislation. You could, if you just deal with the matter in that manner. Our response is that there is a regulation of trust property bill that is in advanced stage of development by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, which will replace the current Trust Property Control Act, and it will be a very thorough and up-to-date review of the legislation and replace that act in its entirety. So this will be forthcoming in the near future. The Department of Justice is in an advanced stage of development of that legislation. And it is submitted that because of the specific nature of trust as a very particular and specific type of entity that is quite different from companies and certain other types of entities, it is very important that there will need to be a specific legislation that deals specifically and appropriately with trusts. In respect of the power to make regulations, it's noted that there isn't a specific any criteria to limit or define the minister's power to make regulations, and this means that the minister will have an unfettered discretionary power to make regulations specifying prescribed information relating to beneficial owners of trusts and that trustees and the master will be required to keep and make available to any person. It is noted that the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development will make all regulations available for consultation, public consultation prior to promulgation. It's also important to note that the powers to make regulations, it is delimited by being information that's directly related to determining and being able to determine beneficial ownership in relation to trusts. So that's the purpose for which the information is obtained, and information that's requested must be related to that specific purpose. And all of the powers, including the powers to make, well, especially the powers to make subordinate legislation, are delimited by the Constitution, and so they must also be exercised in accordance with constitutional requirements. So the power to make the regulations is not unlimited and unfettered, and it must be related to the particular purpose and be appropriate and necessary for that purpose. And there will be opportunity to comment, you know, on the content of the regulations. So if there is any content that commentators might feel is not appropriate or related to the purpose of assessing beneficial ownership of trusts, then that could certainly be highlighted in comments and would be taken into consideration before finalizing the regulations. And then there were some further comments relating to the definition of beneficial owner in the Trust Property Control Act. And so there were some specific comments, including that there might be certain provisions that might open the door for premature vesting of certain rights on beneficiaries of the trust, and could it encroach on the discretion of trustees and limit the existing rights of trustees and founders of a trust. And the proposed insertion of Section 11A in the Act by Clause 5 of the bill refers to beneficial ownership instead of beneficial owner, a term which is not defined in the Act or the legislation generally. And the existing definition of trust is correctly reflecting the legal position in South African trust law, and a trustee cannot be, by virtue only of the office of trustee, be a beneficial owner of the trust property. A trustee is not a beneficial owner of a trust and should not be included in the definition. And finally, there's no indication as to how far a trustee must go to establish the beneficial ownership. So in light of these very helpful comments and all of the comments that have been received regarding the definitions of beneficial ownership in the various pieces of legislation, we will be submitting refined definitions to the committee for their deliberation and consideration. So we certainly appreciate all of the very pertinent and helpful comments that have been made by commentators on the definitions, so that we can ensure that we appropriately finalize the definitions of beneficial owner. And then moving on to amendments to the Trust Property or Nonprofit Organizations Act, it was noted that that the independence of civil society might be undermined. And it was argued that the recommendations are not aligned to the FATF recommendations 8. And it was highlighted that the NPO directorate doesn't have the necessary systems or abilities to do the auditing and requirements and watchdog work that will be required by the proposals. And it was highlighted that organizations exceeding 1 million rand per year and trusts should be registered with the CIPC as nonprofit companies, as the CIPC systems are better capacitated for collecting and refining data than those of the NPO directorate, and onerous administration may be required for smaller nonprofit organizations. And it was recommended not to link the definition of the type of funding entity in question to domicile, as this has always been a very difficult concept to pin down legally, and there will be little clarity on which individuals fall within the definition of having a foreign domicile or not. And so it was suggest omitting reference to the funding of foreign individuals in South Africa. And the bill is not necessary to prohibit NPOs from engaging in money laundering or the financing of terrorism, because existing legislation already caters for this requirement. And the proposed requirement that no association may operate unless registered would violate the fundamental right in the Bill of Rights of everyone to freedom of association. And so in light of all of these submissions on relating to the nonprofit organizations, and having carefully considered all of the submissions and proposals, the National Treasury will submit detailed proposals to adjust the initially proposed blanket registration requirement for NPOs and to address certain other concerns which have been raised. And the proposals focus on the registration of a limited subset of NPOs, those that make donations or provide services beyond South Africa's borders, where they could potentially be used intentionally or unintentionally in the financing of terrorism. And we'll go into these proposals a bit further, slightly later in this presentation. And then there were concerns raised about the inappropriateness for the Department of Social Development to be accommodating the nonprofit directorate. And it was argued that it's not an appropriate place for the register of information to sit, and they would support a registry or oversight body that serves and enables the full scope and ambit of nonprofit work. And it should not be housed under a government department, but should be given the status of an independent statutory body reporting to Parliament. And perhaps this could be achieved either by shifting and upgrading the current directory or establishing a completely new institution. And a wide consultation process would have to be followed in setting up such an independent registry. And it was further commented that it would be appropriate to consider adding a definition to the FIC Act of a cross-border nonprofit entity, as the supporting institution structure already exists in the FIC Act. And it was proposed adding to Schedule 3 of the FIC Act this class of entity as an effective way of exercising oversight and empowering intervention. And the new Companies Act does not include an easy mechanism for the conversion of voluntary associations to nonprofit companies, and suggest including a mechanism allowing voluntary associations to easily convert to a nonprofit company without losing its history. We've noted some of the plans that are underway to try to enhance the capacity of the NPO system and the DSD in its functions, and also their plans to enhance the NPO system. And this will hopefully help with supervision of the NPOs that would fall within the scope of the legislation, and those that are in particular that are determined to be high risk. The aspect of where the entity should be situated is something that is not really able to be given consideration to at this stage. The directorate is situated in the department, but certainly these comments are recognized, and going forward with, especially with the registries, et cetera, further work can perhaps be considered about how the registries and the overall oversight and supervision can be most appropriately accommodated. And the proposal to bring the category of NPOs that would be regulated under the FIC Act, it was determined that wouldn't be appropriate, as then you would have some NPOs being regulated under the FIC and some under the directorate. And so it wouldn't be desirable to have sort of a split regulation or oversight of those NPOs. And so it is at this stage deemed to be most appropriate, and with this legislation, to have the registry situated in the directorate, and the directorate play the role that it currently is given in terms of the legislation. With respect to the proposal in relation to the Companies Act amendments, further consideration can be given to this proposal. But this would be appropriate to consider in the forthcoming Companies Act Amendment Bill process. Then there was a proposal to amend the definition of office bearer. And so these proposals were not submitted are not supported. And perhaps some consideration can be given to refining that definition during the Nonprofit Organization Amendment Bill process, which is already sort of has been commenced. And Currently, governing structures in voluntary associations are referred to as office bearers, and those are those who have the governing powers in the nonprofit organizations. And other staff members, managers, are those who are referred to in the term executive. Then there were some comments on requirements for regulation, clause 10, and it was recommended that section 12.3 and 30 of the NPO Act be amended to specify that the Department of Social Development could not require changes to religious organizations' founding document that would interfere with religious organizations' doctrines, tenets, and beliefs, and to remove the imprisonment and or a limitless fine in the case of noncompliance. And it was commented that the bill would discriminate against smaller community-based nonprofits that lack the administrative skill and resources, thus prejudicing the poor. And so it was recommended that the prerequisite for limited ambit compulsory registration as an MPO would need to be that the directorate kept a list of these organizations separate from those of voluntary NPO organizations so that they can be separately tracked, and the staffing and skills at the NPO directorate would need to be overhauled and upgraded, and people with legal, forensic, and audit skills should be on the team. And so we've noted these comments very carefully, and these have been taken into account in the proposed amendments that we will discuss a bit further in the presentation. And then there was comments on clause 11, duty to provide reports and information. And it was noted that civil society cannot be sustainably independent of political interference when NPOs are required to submit information of this nature to political authorities. And the minister will have unfettered discretionary power to make regulations specifying any prescribed information regarding a nonprofit organization's office bearers, control structure, governance, management, administration, and operations, which the organization must provide to the director. So it's noted that the power of the minister to make regulations is not unfettered, and the proposed regulations will be published for public comment prior to the regulations being finalized and promulgated. And it's important to note that the purpose of the information is so that it is able to be determined who the office bearers are, what the organization's control structure is, and its governance, management, and administration arrangements are, which is necessary information in order to be able to determine if the MPO may potentially be subject to abuse as a conduit for terrorism financing. And the purpose for obtaining the information is strictly for the purposes of having the ability to be able to understand who ultimately may be exercising a sort of control over the functioning of the NPOs and identify when there may be risks posed to an NPO that it may be potentially being at risk of abuse for terrorism financing. And so the information is being collected for a very particular purpose. The purpose is an important and relevant function. And the nature of the information will be rationally connected to the purpose. And also the regulations will be subject to public consultation. In the provision to have disqualification and removal of office bearers, it would be unacceptable to allow government such a direct say in who may or may not occupy senior positions in organizations that are required to be independent of the state. And this is allowed on the strength of present proposed provisions. And it says nothing stops the government in future, for instance, from adding additional grounds for the disqualification. And it's essential to note that it is very important to ensure that only fit and proper persons are able to occupy key positions in organizations such as directors of companies, and the disqualification provisions are very much modeled on the provisions for directors of companies in the Companies Act, also trustees and office bearers of NPOs, because of the role that they play and the potential impact of the exercise of their role. And the criteria that are specified in the disqualification provisions are objective and are not subjective, and they are aligned with those in the Companies Act. And also it's relevant to note in financial sector legislation, fit and proper requirements are also legislated in order to ensure that financial institutions run by persons who are not run by persons who are defined as being disqualified and who have appropriate expertise and experience, and also who uphold characteristics of honesty and integrity. And so it is quite appropriate to set such objective requirements to ensure the appropriate running of such important entities, and to ensure that that also the interests of the public and society at large are protected by ensuring that these companies are properly run and are properly governed. And so fit proper requirements are an important underpinning for good governance of organizations. And these sorts of requirements are, as noted, widely provided for in financial sector legislation, the companies legislation, and in other key legislation where it is critical to have fit and proper persons who are running the entities. And in this instance, we're trying to ensure that entities may not be misused or abused for purposes which would be harmful both to even the members of the organization and also generally to society. So it is important to be able to provide for rational and objective disqualification requirements. And if there were any additional grounds, these would go through a legislative amendment process, and they would be, again, subject to public comment and consultation. Then looking at a final comment on Clause 59 relating to the Financial Sector Regulation Act. And again, it was noted that the provision confers on the regulator unfettered discretionary powers to make standards that prescribe what would or would not constitute ownership or control of a financial institution, or the ability to exercise such control and exclude specified persons from the definition of a beneficial owner of a financial institution. And it also unduly delegates to the financial sector regulators the power to amend the proposed statutory definition of beneficial owner and its descriptions of what constitutes ownership and control, and to create exclusions from that statutory definition. And it would thus be preferable if stipulations about what constitutes or does not constitute ownership or control of financial institutions, or the ability to exercise such control, and stipulations to exclude anyone from the definition of beneficial owner of a financial institution were introduced by way of a statutory amendment rather than by mere delegated legislation in the form of standards issued by a statutory regulator. It's important to note that subordinate legislation such as standards cannot amend primary legislation. So subordinate legislation can elucidate additional detail and provide guidance in relation to primary legislation, but it cannot alter the ultimate scope of the primary legislation. And that's a fundamental principle of the hierarchy of legislation. And the powers to make standards are not unfettered, and the purpose of the standards would be to enable the possibility to provide for further detail and guidance into relation to how beneficial ownership may be applied in relation to different types of persons and financial institutions, so that the meaning of beneficial ownership can be appropriately applied in different contexts. And this is an approach that is being adopted in relation to the application of beneficial ownership in legislative frameworks in other jurisdictions, because it is difficult in a definition in a statute, you know, to provide detail about all of the possible circumstances and types of entities that may arise. And inevitably you would end up missing or perhaps not ideally defining the types of entities that would be included and how it should be applied in relation to those entities. So enabling this to some additional detail to be provided in subordinate legislation can assist overall in ensuring that the definition itself is ultimately applied appropriately in various different and sometimes quite diverse contexts. And it's also important to note that the standards will be published for comment and tabled in Parliament before they are finally published and become effective. So there is certainly the opportunity for public comment on the content of the regulations or of the subordinate legislation. And then we would just like to provide a little bit more detail on the proposed approach to registration of NPOs. We did provide some feedback in the last meeting. And so in light of further consideration of further comments regarding the proposed mandatory registration of all NPOs, and after consideration, proposed drafting refinements are presented to the committee for consideration. And as we noted in the last meeting, not all NPOs would be required to register, and the following NPOs would be required to register. Those that make donations to individuals or organizations domiciled in a foreign country, including when such individuals are physically in South Africa, and any NPO that provides humanitarian, charitable, religious, educational, or other services outside of South Africa's borders. And so in the proposed drafting refinements that I'll get to in a couple of minutes, do sort of specify the categories of NPOs that would be required to register. All other NPOs would remain with the option of voluntary registration. And in our proposals, wording would be proposed to make it explicitly clear that the directorate does not have the discretion to refuse registration if the requirements of the Act are complied with. And currently, Section 13.2 provides that if the applicant for registration complies with the requirements of the Act, then it must be registered. And similarly, a wording will be proposed to make it explicitly clear that the grounds on which nonprofit organizations could be deregistered could only be exercised in relation to non-compliance with requirements in the Act. And currently, the grounds for cancellation, as set out in Section 20, are non-compliance with requirements of the Act or with a provision of its constitution, which has not been rectified after receipt of a notice contemplated in that section. And then in relation to the constitution of an NPO, and it will be explicitly stated that the director, that the basis on which the directorate could require an NPO to change its constitution could only be exercised, if it is necessary to, that the constitution doesn't in fact cover all of the matters required in section 12.2. And the grounds on which registration might be refused or on which an NPO might be deregistered or required to amend its constitution would then be very clearly limited. And refusals or on any other basis or requirements to amend the constitution on any other grounds would not be able to be considered by the directorate. And all public power must be exercised in accordance with the constitution and in compliance with the Bill of Rights and the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. And so all of these powers of registration or potential deregistration or the power to require amendments to the constitution are then very clearly subject to the constitution and the PAJA. And so as that's expressly set out in those pieces of legislation, then in the Constitution and the Pacha, then it's not necessarily to expressly state that in other legislation, such as the NPO Act. We had considered, expressly stating that in the legislation, but general drafting practice is that it isn't necessary in all legislation to be stating that the Constitution, that the legislation and the exercise of all of the powers in terms of the legislation are subject to the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, because that it, the Constitution states that all legislation is subject to the Bill of Rights and the exercise of all public power and the performance of all public functions are subject to the Bill of Rights. So that doesn't have to necessarily be restated in all legislation. And it's submitted that if the powers are clearly delineated as proposed, and in light of the application of the Constitution and the Pacha to all other legislation, and that the powers of registration, deregistration, and the power to requirements amendment to be made to an NPO's constitution may not be exercised in a manner that would potentially infringe on rights contained in the Bill of Rights, including the rights to freedom of association and freedom of religion. So just to give a sense of sort of some of the wording that is proposed to be included to address some of the concerns. So one set of amendments is to section 12. Refinements would be proposed to section 12. And so it would be proposed to amend subsection 1 to paragraph A to provide that a nonprofit organization referred to in paragraph B must apply, and any other nonprofit organization that is an organ of state may apply to the director for registration, subject to paragraph C and in accordance with prescribed registration requirements. And a nonprofit organ, and then B sets out those categories of nonprofit organizations that would be required to be registered, and that would be nonprofit organizations that make donations to individuals or organizations domiciled in a foreign country, including when such individuals are physically beyond the Republic's borders, or that provides humanitarian, charitable, religious, educational, or cultural services outside of the Republic's borders. And then paragraph C would provide that a nonprofit organization referred to in paragraph B that is operating but is not registered in terms of this act on the date of commencement of this provision must register within a period determined by the minister by notice in the Gazette in accordance with prescribed transitional arrangements and registration requirements. So then, the period, there would be a transitional period that would be provided for registration of NPOs that would be required to be registered, but which currently are not already registered. And then paragraph D would provide that a registered nonprofit organization and a nonprofit organization referred to in paragraph B, whether it is in fact registered in terms of the act or not, must comply with the requirements of this act. So then those nonprofit organizations that are required to be registered and those which choose to voluntarily register would then be subject to the provisions of the act. And then we would propose amendments to subsection 2 of section 12 in at the beginning of that subsection to say that unless the laws in terms of which a nonprofit organization is established or incorporated make provision for the matters in this subsection, the constitution of a nonprofit organization that is required in terms of subsection 1A to register or intends to register must. And then in subsection 3, we would propose some revisions to the wording at the beginning of that subsection to say constitution of a supervised entity, supervised a nonprofit organization that is required to register or that intends to register may make provision for matters relevant to the conducting its affairs. And then we would propose the insertion of a subsection 4 to say that the director, when considering an application for registration in terms of section 13, after having received amendments to the Constitution, section 19, or at any other time, may only require a nonprofit organization to make an alteration to its constitution to ensure that the constitution addresses the matters referred to in subsection 2. And then we would propose some refinements to section 13. And in particular, we would propose adjusting the wording at the beginning of subsection 1, just to reflect that certain nonprofit organizations would be required to apply for registration. And so the phrasing may apply would not be appropriate to retain in all instances. And the insertion after subsection 3 of the following subsection is proposed. And so subsection 3A, to make it clear that the director must register a nonprofit organization that complies with the requirements for registration in section 12. There will be some other more minor proposals that will be proposed for amendments to the Nonprofit Organization Act, but these are the main amendments that we would be proposing in that regard. And so we will, in the next meeting, submit a list of detailed amendments that we would propose for consideration by the committee to all of the pieces of legislation covered in the bill and the existing amendments. So that completes our presentation. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members.
Thank you, Janine and Vukile, for their responses. Let's move to item 3, where participants will react. You are allocated 3 minutes. I will request that you time yourself so that we are able to save time. Let's start with Concerto, 3 minutes. What to you? Are you there, Comrade Mark, or who is in the platform? Comrade Matthews? Alan?
Chair, I don't think Matthew is on the platform.
And his colleague from the one was here last time, was he from Sakau?
Yes, Chair Etienne, I don't see him here either.
Okay. Let's proceed. Ama Bungan and Corruption Watch, over to you, 3 minutes.
Thank you very much, Chair. And thank you to National Treasury for the very detailed presentation. I think we certainly appreciate the efforts that have been put into responding to the concerns about the compulsory registration of NPOs. I think that we will have to examine the proposed amendments in a little bit more detail and compare it to our sort of submissions and international practice. But as I said, we are grateful for the response and the willingness to amend it and to remove that compulsory registration by creating a certain subset of NGOs that are required to register. So thank you very much. I think that covers our submissions.
Okay, thanks, Caroline from Mama Bungan and Corruption Watch. Next, NPO Working Group.
Hello, yes, can you hear me? Am I coming through?
Loud and clear.
Thank you, colleagues. First, thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for the detailed feedback. We really appreciate the engagement. As others have said, I'll rattle quickly through a couple of points. We're very happy to hear the update of the trust's laws that are underway. We suggest that the Justice Department is advised not to sidestep the nonprofit sector in any consultation process it might be engaged in, as we will be impacted by those amendments. Number two, we look forward to engaging with those detailed proposed amendments. Could we ask for a little more than 18 hours notice of the promised next meeting? That would be very useful in order to prepare. Our main point is that we maintain our view that the NPO Directorate is not the appropriate body for mandatory registration of the defined class of nonprofits. Those who support this registration under the NPO Directorate are vastly underestimating the extent of intervention, improvement, overhaul, staffing, training, systems, transplant, funding, and time that will be required to get things up to speed in that department. And we also maintain our view around the political and credibility unacceptability of where the NPO Directorate is currently located. So I'm making that very clear because there are parts of the sector who will continue to vehemently protest that. This was brand new in the last lot of submissions. Suggestion that instead of placing this class of nonprofits under the NPO Directorate, we add to FICA's Schedule 3 a list of at-risk nonprofits or a class. This class of at-risk nonprofits is not a splitting of responsibility, in fact, but it's a concentration of responsibility for a specific type of oversight under an appropriately focused and resourced authority. I know you've had little time to engage with that submission, but we think it has merit and that it might be a much simpler way to resolve the current situation. If I have a few seconds left to drill down to one very important detail, which is that contrary to the response given, the NPO Act currently does define office bearer as director, trustee, or person holding an executive position. In this definition, it is referring to the board of a nonprofit company by using the word director, to the trustees of a trust when it uses the word trustee, but there is no reference in that definition to the committee members or proper governing body of a voluntary association. What this means is that if this definition is not amended, it will be a different set of people and an inappropriate set of people that will be held to account in voluntary associations when compared to those who are being held to account in nonprofit companies and trusts. It is the governing body, the body which holds fiduciary ultimate responsibility, who should be defined and who should be being held accountable. So if that detail could please be paid attention to, because it's critical that everything pins on the right crowd of people. And besides that, all provisions promoting good governance and fitness of office are supported. And we look forward to the further engagement. Thank you, colleagues.
Thanks, Nicole from NPO Holding Group. Next, Freedom of Religion, SA.
Good morning, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Committee members. Having considered the presentation by Treasury this morning, it is concerning that the proposal for those NPOs, those organisations that fall within the definition of NPOs that would have to mandatory register with the department, would still include most religious organisations. As per our verbal submissions to the committee and Treasury during last week's engagements, many religious organizations support other religious organizations in other countries, or even just individuals such as missionaries in other countries. And I use the example of with COVID, many churches set up a COVID relief fund for humanitarian work in other countries. And thus saying that if you make donations or provide services internationally, that very broad blanket, you would have to mandatory register with the DSD, it's still too wide. And at-risk NPOs can't be defined simply as Treasury is suggesting for this reason, because it's so wide, it's going to capture almost all religious organizations in the country, of which there are many, many thousands. Now, 4SA would support a definition of, for example, NPOs that are required to mandatory register to be those MPOs that provide money or services to specific entities, such as, for example, those entities identified in a United Nations Security Council resolution, for example, as per Section 5 of the Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorism-Related Activities Act of 2004. I also just want to point out that the truth is that it's exceptionally hard to send money overseas. The South African Reserve Bank blocks one unless you make an application to SARB via your bank, for which you pay a few thousand rand for the application. And then they approve it and you can pay upon receipt from an invoice from the overseas entity or individual. And even for individuals, SARB gives you specific limits that you can send overseas. And the banks always trigger with SARB and the bank shuts you down unless you meet all these requirements. So again, it's unclear how these proposals are actually going to help combat terrorism financing. And to avoid interference with religious organizations, please can the committee look at narrowing down which NPOs need to register. Again, 4SA's proposal would be that this would be for entities that provide money or services to specifically identified entities, for example, those identified by a UN Security Council resolution in terms of the Protection of Constitutional Democracy Against Terrorism and Related Activities Act. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thanks, Daniela. Freedom of Religion, SA. Next, Cause for Justice.
Good morning, Chairperson and Committee. Firstly, I would just like to say we appreciate the feedback from Treasury and the work that's being put into it and that they are considering the submission. So we are encouraged by the move away from blanket compulsory registration. However, we do need an opportunity to study the detailed proposals a bit further, and we also look forward to receiving the further detailed proposals that were alluded to and comparing it against our submissions. So in that sense, we share the sentiment by Amabungane and Corruption Watch. Similarly to 4SA, we are very concerned that all religious organizations will still be caught by the registration requirements, as many do work overseas, make demand donations to organizations overseas. We are not satisfied that the religious freedom is protected explicitly and strongly enough. And we also share 4SA's proposal and recommendation, we support it, that this narrow, the entities that should register, that should be narrowed down. We also share NGOs Law's concerns with regard to the NPO directorate, that it's the correct entity to properly oversee the requirements of the Act as far as regulation oversight is concerned. And we would also like, really appreciate a bit longer notice of meetings. That is all our comments for this stage. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Lizelle. Cause for Justice. Media Monitoring Africa, MMA.
It doesn't seem like they online either, Chair.
Okay. Let's move to the next stakeholder, Open Ownership.
Thank you so much, Chairperson, and thank you to National Treasury for another very detailed and thoughtful review of the comments and some very thoughtful reviews of, in particular, the definition of beneficial ownership. Because I had a conflict this morning, I was unable to attend the full meeting, so I'll take a look at the comments as shared by National Treasury and look forward to studying that further. Thank you for your time.
Okay, let's move to JSE.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and committee members. The JSE is grateful for the opportunity to respond to National Treasury's responses today. We have engaged in very constructive discussions with National Treasury, the FIC, the SIPSI team, and on our submission, and further proposed amendments. We will continue to offer our assistance where required in the coming days. We wish to express our appreciation for the manner and the quality of engagement by National Treasury and the team. We are encouraged that we're moving in a direction that will achieve the legislative objectives and legislation that can be effectively implemented by both the regulatory authorities and listed companies. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Anne, JSE. COSATU and who else? MMA are not here.
Yes, Chair, I don't see them online.
Okay. Then let's move to the next item. Item 4, interaction by committee members. Honorable members, it's your opportunity now to ask clarity-seeking questions or make comments. Louis van Vieren, Dr. George, Swart, Honorable Abraham, in that order.
Yes, I'm not a member of the committee. I'm a representative of FISA, who also made a submission. So if you would allow me, I would also like to make some comments on Treasury's reaction.
Make it clear again, Louis. I didn't get it clear, yeah. And just
I'm a representative of the Fiduciary Institute of Southern Africa, FISA, and we also made presentations. So we are a stakeholder.
Alan, what happened? As they are not here in the program on item 3.
Chair, Mr. Van Vieren represents, FISA. They've made a submission, but they haven't done a presentation. And the people that we scheduled on the program are those that made presentations to the committee. It's obviously up to you if you want to allow him to speak, Chair.
Okay, Louis, can you use 3 minutes of your time to quickly make a submission so that I can invite honorable members to respond.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. Chair, let me start first by saying that FISA is thankful that the definition of beneficial owner will be redrafted as it appears in the Trust Property Control Act. Speaking of which, FISA has offered repeatedly in the past to render assistance in the drafting of new trust property control legislation, and we are surprised to hear that there's a bill in an advanced stage. We have offered our services to the Office of the Chief Master of the High Court, and it seems now there was no uptake on that offer. We think we can bring some benefit to that process. We are not opposed to duties of disclosure, let me make that clear, but our view is that duties of disclosure must not be cumbersome to the point of making fiduciary practice unprofitable, and we think there is a real danger that that could happen. Such duties must also not be duplicatory of other duties placed on other entities or do investigative authorities' job for them. We think balance is needed there. Then, into the meat of our submission, the concept of beneficial ownership is totally foreign to South African property law and trust law. It stems from Anglo-American common law system, where this definition comes from. South Africa has a hybrid legal system, common law as well as civil law. Our property and trust law recognizes undivided ownership, functionally undivided ownership. So the concept that functional ownership can be divided into legal ownership and beneficial ownership is totally foreign to South African law. There is no mention in Treasury's comment on our contention that the definition of beneficial ownership is in conflict with the definition of trust in the Trust Property Control Act. There is a comment that they do not understand why our comment that beneficial ownership is in conflict with Section 9 of the Trust Property Control Act, the fiduciary duty. That comment is built on the conflict between the definition of beneficial ownership and the definition of trust as it appears in the Trust Property Control Act. We look forward to seeing the revised draft of the definition of beneficial ownership. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Louis, for your contribution. Let's move back to honorable members, Dr. George, Pastor Steve, Honorable Abraham. Dr. George.
Thank you, Chairperson. I do think we're moving in the right direction, because, yes, I'm also very concerned about the registration of NPOs, which I think is problematic. I'm just wondering why it would be with the Department of Social Development that this registration would need to happen. Because if there's concern that there's a specific category of NPO that may present a more of a risk, for example, then surely they can be surveilled in another way via an accountable institution, for example, such as a bank, etc. We do in fact have the FIC. So I'm just not understanding why it is that this registration is necessary. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. George. Pastor Steve?
No, Chair, I also appreciate the fact that we seem to be moving in the right direction, but I think I really want to plead with the National Treasury. You need to really consider the constitutional issues relating to religious organizations in addition to the constitutional issues relating to normal MPAs. There's a distinct legal separation. And whilst I argue that all MPOs do not need mandatory registration and we're moving in the correct direction, clearly thousands of religious organizations will still be impacted, thousands of MPOs will still be impacted, both of which have the constitutional rights of association. And in addition, religious organizations have the religious rights plus the doctrine of entanglement. Now that relates to any proposed amendments to the Constitution, which in my view, and I'd be open to persuasion, but that goes directly against what is being proposed where there's a possibility of amendments to the Constitution. And that is a great concern to us. And I want to hear more in that regard to be persuaded. Secondly, I still don't understand why it's coming under the Department of Social Development. We all are aware, and I'm not satisfied with the issue to say there'll be additional capacity. I've been in Parliament long enough to know that departments, and in particular social development, had to be taken to the Constitutional Court to basically just provide social grants. So to say they'll be given additional capacity is not persuasive. I'm afraid that they already have severe constraints when it comes to even dealing with grants. And now to give them this additional burden is to me not going to be able to be implemented. It's incumbent upon us as members of Parliament to ensure that when we pass laws, not only are they constitutionally compliant, which I doubt this case, but secondly, whether they can be implemented and what the costing is going to be. So that is a very, very severe issue that I have. I do not think that the Department of Social Development will be able to do what is required when it comes to the additional thousands and thousands of MPOs. And I would strongly urge Treasury to look at the proposals that come about, possibly bringing them under the schedule in FICA, other ways, given the fact that you want to fight terrorism funding and money laundering. It's almost like using a sledgehammer to deal with a gnat, as they say. So I want a serious look at that. The last aspect that I'm still not satisfied with is the issue relating to if you as an MPO are a registered nonprofit company under the CIPC or you're a registered public benefit organization under SARS or a non-charitable trust under the Masters Act, the Trust Property Control Act, why must you be registered again? When I put the question last time, the answer that was given to me was not all MPOs are covered by this act. Sure, but what? I would like you to consider a proposal that says, despite the provisions of Section 1, should a nonprofit organization be registered as a nonprofit company in terms of the CIPC, in terms of the Companies Act, as a public benefit organization in terms of the Income Tax Act or whatever it is under SARS, or as a non-charitable trust in terms of the Trust Property Control Act, that nonprofit organization need not register with the department in terms of this act? That would be a firm proposal from my side. I would need, and at some stage, I will, unless I am persuaded that there is a need for dual registration. One of the comments that Janine made was to enable seamless cooperation between the regulatory authorities. We had information about all the data moving, so I don't see any reason why, if an MPO is not already registered, why they need to register again in terms of this act. Given, and if understand that if there is an MPO that is not registered in terms of that act and qualifies to the narrower definitions, they'd fall under this. But I'd really need a persuasion in that regard. But thank you. We seem to be moving in the right direction. I appreciate the engagement from Treasury. I understand the pressures you are under. I do. But we need to just make sure we don't have unintended consequences. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pastor Steve. Honorable Abraham, I see De Villiers is here now. Honorable Abraham.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Thank you so much. Let me add my voice as well on commending the detailed response by Treasury. So yes, we appreciate what Vukile and Janine have presented to us. Chair, my first question is around the issue of the time that was a burning issue when we last interacted with stakeholders. I hear that the department is looking at using regulations to accept public comment without really extending the time. Just checking whether that is sufficient to accommodate the fact that stakeholders were complaining about the timing. My second issue is the issue of registration of businesses with CIPC. I would like to check with the department as to whether there isn't a necessity for the Justice Department to also kind of run an awareness campaign or a public participation program that will ensure that the public, specifically interested stakeholders, are informed. Lastly, Chair, for me, it's about the inappropriateness of the Department of Social Development to keep the register, I think. I would have loved to have more comment on that. What is it that the department, that is National Treasury, is recommending? Thank you so much, Chair.
Thanks, Noxie. Honorable De Villiers.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, colleagues. Apologies that I was a little bit late into the meeting this morning. Thank you from my side as well for the progress which we do seem to be making on this issue. Without making or taking everyone's time, I just want to add my voice to the real and genuine concern about using the Department of Social Development for this function. It's in my mind not good enough to say they will be capacitated. It is not within their core function to do this job. And I think that the real question should be under what department is similar work being done? You know, is it justice, maybe treasury? Where the right department is, you know, can be discussed, but it certainly is not the DSD. And I would just like to really urge, and I think that the committee is speaking, as far as I can ascertain, in one voice on this issue. The DSD is not the right department for this function. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable De Villiers. Treasury, will you be able to respond to the issues raised by stakeholders and honorable members before we move towards closure?
Yes, Chair, thanks so much for all the comments, both on the from those who submitted comments, stakeholders and the committee members. There's obviously a very wide range of comments, Chair, so you'll forgive me if I need to be reminded if we miss one or two. I'll also be relying very heavily on Janine and the FIC to help me through some of those comments. So Chair, we On the stakeholders, if I could start with them, we have had, as a couple of stakeholders had indicated, additional bilateral engagements and tried very hard to sort of bridge the distance. And I think that, as is I think recognized, we've made significant improvements, and I think that where we are now, we're very close to a place where we would all be quite comfortable, save maybe a few specific issues that were identified. Chair, I'm going to hand over to Janine, but maybe just to have a comment on one issue that was reoccurring, which seems to be a significant issue, and that really relates to the role of the Department of Social Development. Chair, I would underline, notwithstanding some of the comments that have already been articulated, I thought it would just be appropriate at the outset to underscore the commitment as articulated in the Minister's budget, medium-term budget policy statement, that we will be that there will be additional resources specifically aimed at helping with the fight against corruption, including of course the response to the mutual evaluation, but also the recommendations that have been made under the state capture in budget 2023, with additional allocations Chair being made to specific departments and agencies to help in that process. So Chair, if there was any skepticism about the commitment at the national level by obviously through the executive to adequately resource those entities that are responsible or will have a responsibility or the mandate that the bill outlines, that those additional resources will be made available. Having said that, Chair, we certainly take on the comments and concerns about beyond just financial or budgetary commitments around the effectiveness and making sure that we have the most streamlined approach. And we will certainly consider the specific requests and recommendations made about the location of the registry. But I thought that just in answering that, I think it's just important to note that there is a stated a commitment to make sure the departments are adequately resourced to meet the objectives of this bill. Let me hand over to Janine to take us through some of the specific suggestions around the clauses, and I think Peter Smith from the FIC will also come in there, Chair, and then I may come in at the end just to sum up as well. Thank you, Chair. So over to you, Janine.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Coming on a couple of the points that were raised by the stakeholders, we would just note that the submission by FISA is a submission that we had not fully responded to in this particular presentation. It was indicated at the beginning of the presentation that there were a few of the submissions that we had received slightly later than the others, and so we will certainly provide a full response on the FISA submission in the next meeting. We certainly want to fully engage with those comments and provide full responses. I think in relation to the one aspect of that of the presentation that was made by the colleague from FISA today, I don't know if Peter Smith would just like to come in briefly on what the FATF requirements say in relation to trusts.
Thank you very much, Janine. Yeah, so I think that the objective that we need to achieve with the amendments in respect of transparency in relation to trust arrangements is that the natural persons who are associated with a trust, either as a founder or trustee or a specifically named beneficiary, should all be identifiable, and that the information about those entities should be held by, in our law, it would be the trustee, that the person whoever is responsible for executing the terms of the trust instrument. The direction in which the standards are moving in, that will be coming our way in the near future, is that this same information that would have to be held by the trustee would also then have to be shared with the central repository, a database or register where that information can then be aggregated and co-located with the information about the trusts that are operating within a particular jurisdiction. So while we are trying to address the finding in the mutual evaluation report in this respect, we're also looking at what's coming our way and make sure that the proposals that we're working with here places us in a good position that we also anticipate those changes, and we don't have to come back to the and revisit this issue again when we have to move to the next step of assembling this sort of a central database of trust related information. We certainly take account of the comments and the advice from FISA, and I don't think we disagree with that. We fully understand the conundrum that we have to make this in this concept fit into the specific concepts of our trust law, where a trust is not an entity, a trust is the result of an instrument, an agreement or a will or something to that effect. The trust in and of itself is not something that is susceptible to being owned in the same way that a company, for instance, can be owned. It does not have legal personality, etc. We understand those concepts fully. What we have undertaken to do and what we will spend our time on over the next few days is to see if how the defined terms for the Trust Property Control Act can be further adjusted to better take account of these realities of our trust law in comparison with the international standard. I think just to underscore the point that with the intention with the definition is not to imply any additional entitlements or ownership in terms of legal concepts in our law for any of the particular entities that where that would be inappropriate in terms of our current trust law. It's simply to find a term that can be described and used as a defined terminology that then can be linked to the transparency requirements of having the identity information of certain natural persons recorded, held by the trustee, and also shared with wherever the central repository of that information will be located. Janine, I don't know if you want me to move on to some of the comments on the NPO registration, or do you want to come back to that later? I'd be happy to comment whenever you need me.
No, you could certainly proceed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Janine. Many of the comments were made about the location of where the registration function should be placed for whichever category of NPOs would be required to go through a form of a registration requirement. And some of the proposals that were made would be to bring in an NPO, or this category of NPOs, under the FIC Act by including them within the schedules of the FIC Act, either as accountable institutions, in other words, or as reporting institutions, that which are the two schedules that the FIC Act provide for. Now, to respond to that, I think it's useful just to remind members and participants of what the FIC Act requires of institutions that are covered by the schedules of the FIC Act. If an institution is included in Schedule 1 to the FIC Act, it's an accountable institution, and there's a significant range of obligations that come with that for such an institution. To understand its risks of abuse, to manage those risks through having a compliance program in place, which is monitored by the management of that institution, to provide training to its staff, to conduct customer due diligence, in other words, to know who the customers are of that institution, to conduct ongoing due diligence on relationships that it has with its customers, to identify politically exposed persons that it may be dealing with. These are not the type of obligations that really fit well with the concept of an NPO that doesn't do business, that doesn't have customers, that doesn't interact with its community in the same way that a bank or an insurance company or a financial advisor, etc., does. So it would not be well placed to place the NPO organizations in that category of institutions. The second category is Schedule 3 that requires reporting institutions to report cash transactions over a certain threshold. At the moment, that threshold is 25,000 Rand in cash, and it's soon to be raised to 50,000 Rand in cash. Again, it does not serve our purpose here to require NPOs to report to the FIC when each and every time that they receive a cash amount or they pay out a cash amount in the amount of 25 or 50 or whatever stipulated amount would be in the regulations. That's not the objective of why, in terms of the international standards, one requires supervision of NPOs. We're not sure that, we're not convinced that the burden on NPOs to report these transactions to the FIC is useful, because it does not actually help NPOs to monitor when they might be subject to exploitation, even without their own involvement in the process, to raise funds, for instance, for terrorist organizations, or to fund activity of organizations in other parts of the world where terrorist activity would be taking place. The objectives of the registration requirement is to apply the provisions of the NPO Act that currently is already provided for. Sections, if my memory serves correctly, 12 of the NPO Act onwards to around section 20, somewhere there. That requires an NPO to have very basic things in place, such as a constitution that provides for governance principles, et cetera, et cetera. Those are not obligations that sit in the FIC Act. So even registering an NPO as an organization under the FIC Act would not actually achieve that objective to ensure that those governance principles are in place, that the constitution of the NPO is in place that the NPO abides by its own constitution, etc. And supervision by the FIC cannot address those things. It can only address the requirements of the requirements of the FIC Act. So the FIC would only then be able to supervise NPOs for the reporting obligations that sit in the FIC Act. So in our view, it's firstly not an efficient approach to require registration with the FIC and inclusion in the schedules of the FIC. And the type of supervision that the FIC can exercise is not the appropriate for the objective of the registration requirement. So in our view, that is not the right solution to achieve what we are required to do. The DSD currently, we understand that the practical concern with the DSD's capacity, but as far as core function, legal core function is concerned, that the core function of the DSD NPO directorate isn't exactly to do this sort of supervision, which they are required to do currently with all the NPOs that are currently already registered with it, and there are many thousands of them, that have chosen to follow the registration process of the NPO Act and voluntarily register. The requirements that would be expected of a registered NPO is no different from what the NPO Act currently provides for in respect of those registered NPOs. We are not proposing adding any further requirements for an NPO that is required to register, because the objective is to ensure that those requirements that the NPO Act already currently contain applied to a particular subset of NPOs. The points about automatic or registration under the Companies Act and the trust as a charitable trusts or recognition of public benefit organizations for tax purposes, I think that is a solution that can work if the consequence of registration as a not-for-profit company and or a public benefit organization, etc., is automatically that the NPO is also registered under the NPO Act in this category of NPOs that we're defining, because the registration as a not-for-profit company or the recognition as a public benefit organization, etc., does not automatically bring about the consequence of applying the provisions of the NPO Act that I've referred to just now to those organizations. So it still doesn't get us to that objective unless there's an automaticity built in and one registration then serves more than one purpose. At the moment, we are not exploring that. That is certainly something that if is desirable can be explored in future, but that would mean that NPOs that have had no intention to register under the NPO Act would become automatically registered without their own involvement. We are not 100% sure whether that is a good policy objective to pursue. But as I say, that is something that I think that require more exploration and is a feasible option in the longer term. We don't think that's something that we can immediately achieve with the amendments that we are dealing with right now. In this current process. I think that has covered the comments that I wanted to make, but if necessary, I will try to provide further views and explanations. Thank you, Janine.
Thank you very much, Peter. Just to note one other comment from the stakeholders from NGO law. We will further take a look at the definition of office bearer in light of your points in the committee today. So thank you for highlighting that. So we'll take a further look at that. And then I think in respect of the, we certainly note the concerns raised by committee members and stakeholders about the placement and capacity of the register and the capacitation of the Department of Social Development, the directorate to be carrying out the mandate granted under the legislation. So we will certainly give that further consideration and provide further submissions in the next meeting. But we certainly take note of this, of the serious submissions that have been made today. And we certainly appreciate that, and we will give it a further careful consideration and further thought. We also note the concerns about the religious organizations. And I think, you know, we have given very careful thought about the submissions by the religious organizations. And in that regard, you know, we have tried to ensure that the powers of the directorate in relation to registration or deregistration or the ability to require amendments to the founding documents are extremely clearly delimited, so that, you know, there wouldn't be any scope for, you know, those powers being exercised in a manner sort of based on the nature of the organization and in a manner that could potentially infringe on the right to religion and freedom of association have been particularly highlighted, but generally in relation to fundamental rights in the Bill of Rights as a whole. And in relation to, you know, the exclusion of religious organizations, you know, we also need to treat the NPOs in a fair and consistent manner. And so it is important that the requirements that we set, you know, would be applicable and wouldn't sort of exclude, you know, have different impacts and on different categories of NPOs simply based on the nature of their activity, well, or their association, be it religious or any other type of association. So we need to have that the legislation is consistent and neutral in relation to how it treats all NPOs, and that it doesn't infringe on any NPO's rights of association or and including other fundamental rights, and among which rights to freedom of religion are particularly important. And I'd like to ask Peter maybe to come in further on this point, and maybe also to note some of the experience and information that the FIC has had on in relation to NPOs that may have a religious, you know, be a religious association. Peter, please come in.
Thank you very much, Jenny. So I think just to underscore the first point that in defining or finding a base for defining a category of NPOs that would be required to register under whichever legislation, whether it's FIC Act or NPO Act or any other, we are very, very strongly of the view that that criteria of that determines the category for definition cannot be based or linked to the purpose of the organization, because in our view that would certainly constitute unfair discrimination against that category that is then identified based on their particular purpose for which the NPO is created, and others that perform similar activities but for a different purpose would not be required to register. So in our view, the only way in which this can be avoided is to refer to the activities that qualify an NPO for registration, regardless of the purpose for which the NPO is created. And that would then mean that NPOs created for different purposes that perform the same activity would be required by subject to the same requirements of registration. I think that is a serious concern, that we have a conundrum that a discriminatory measure cannot be unfair in terms of our constitution. And selecting based on a purpose, in our view, it would be very difficult to justify that is not unfair discrimination. Just to the point on experiences, and I fully understand this is a very sensitive issue, but in the experiences and cases that we have seen in the FIC, and I can share a short presentation if necessary, and we can also share this with the committee to be distributed with the documentation for today's meeting. FIC's experience has been, and we have identified cases that we've brought to the attention of investigating authorities where NPOs were in fact used to raise funds in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And the reason why the NPOs were, why that was possible to use the NPO to raise funds in South Africa was because the NPO was positioned not as a business, not as a bank, not as a an entity that has customers, but because it was positioned as an NPO. And for the reason of its NPO title, it was able to convince a donor community to provide funds to this, and those funds were then taken offshore and diverted to entities where there's serious suspicions of terrorist activity or terrorist organizations happening. And unfortunately, in those cases, those NPOs were also styled as religious organizations, and the donations were styled as religious donations. So finding a way of excluding religious organizations specifically from this will again defeat the purpose. Apart from the constitutional conundrum that I mentioned just now, there is a real risk that institutions that pose as a religious organization or religious organizations without their knowledge would be exploited for this particular purpose. And they are well placed, in fact, to be exploited for this purpose. So that unfortunately is a reality that we need to be also addressing in the way in which we go about ensuring that NPOs can protect themselves from this form of exploitation. And the best defense that we have, I've mentioned this in our previous discussions as well, the best defense that an NPO has to protect itself from this sort of exploitation is to have the proper governance process in place, to have proper accounting, a proper implementation of its constitution, control of its office bearers over the organization and its activities, etc. Those are typically the things that is expected of a well-governed, well-run, credible non-profit organization. Those are the principles that are built into the Non-Profit Organizations Act. I think that is the preferable option that we keep on circling back to. Thank you, Janine.
Thank you very much, Peter. Perhaps if you would like to go further into your examples, your presentation, you could do so on the case examples.
Certainly, let me try to share my screen. I'm not able to share my screen, unfortunately, Janine. That was my problem just now. So to share the presentation.
I will try and share it in just a moment here. Let me just find it.
Thank you, Janine. So I think we can move to the next slide. This presentation covered both use of trusts in themselves, and some of those are trusts in the commercial sense and also charitable trusts, and then other forms of non-profit organizations that we've seen. And when we refer to these are not hypothetical cases that we're referring to. These are actual instances that the FIC has identified from its analysis work. So we can move to the next slide. So I think we're making a point here that from our analysis work, we have identified these instances where legitimate structures have received payments. In the case of trusts, it is styled as payments for services, in other words, in a commercial sense. And when we've analyzed and followed the transaction flow, we were able to identify that these funds were eventually directed to organizations that support terrorist activities, not in South Africa, in these cases, the funds were eventually found their way out of the country and outside of the country diverted to organizations that are linked to terrorism. So I think in this case, it indicates for us that the at the end in South Africa, where the funds are raised, there is little ability for the fundraising to identify what is happening with the fund subsequently. It's only when the transaction flow is then analyzed further that one sees this diversion of the funds. Now we can move to the next slide. This is just give an indication of how the structure was set up. One of these structures that we've seen in this instance, as one can see, it's a fairly complex structure, and this comes to some of the points that we were also discussing in respect of trusts and companies and the ability to have information easily accessible on the beneficial ownership concept in both of those instances. In the case of the companies, that information would have been easily found. In the case of a trust, it would have been more difficult to find that information. If the trust was set up as a charitable trust, that information would have been very difficult to find in respect of the, because they wouldn't have been identified beneficiaries and donors, etc., that one would, for instance, have in the case of a family trust. And that is why the things such as having the records of the finances, the office bearers, etc., of those charitable trusts would have been contributing significantly to our ability to work out what the structure is up to, what it's doing, and how it's being used, and in a much shorter space of time. I think that the additional point I would just make on a structure such as this, even though the FIC was able to identify this and collate all of this information in a product that we could share with investigating authorities, to find the actual evidence of what's happening here is proving to be very difficult. So this is based on simply on analysis work and analyzing suspicions that have been reported to the FIC, but to convert this to the level of evidence that can be used in prosecutions, for instance, is proving to be extremely difficult. We can move to the next slide. This refers specifically to either our experience where we've identified NPOs, in this case, the activities of the NPOs involved raising funds, providing relief work elsewhere outside of South Africa. And the purpose for which these NPOs were created was, for instance, with a religious purpose in its foundation. And in these cases, when the transactions were actually executed and we were able to find the traces of the transactions in the reporting systems, for instance, one of the commentators mentioned earlier the work of the Reserve Bank and the Financial Surveillance Department. Those transactions were in fact not indicated as donations or relief work. They were indicated as loans that were made by these organizations where the funds were raised in South Africa. And clearly there's a disjunct in with the purpose and the activities of the organization If the foreign expenses are then identified as loans. We suspect the reason why this has happened is satisfy the classification of these transactions in a particular category in the financial surveillance records, which would not attract much attention. But I think that this sort of activity is the sort of activity that we would be able to analyze more with more accuracy if we had, for instance, access to the NPO's constitution. We're able to analyze what the financial statements of the NPO provide for and how the NPO is managed by its office bearers. Thank you, Janine. I'm not sure if there's another slide. Okay, this again illustrates the structure of this. In the previous example, the particular NPO that we were that attracted our attention, and when one looked at the structure, one can see it's again a fairly complex structure with many accounts held at many different banks by the same NPO, and where funds were flowing back and forth between accounts before eventually being directed out of the country and where the transactions were captured in the financial surveillance system. There's also large amounts of cash in and out of these accounts. Cash into the account, one I think would easily understand as donations. But dispensing in cash would be something again that one would have to look at and see in the accounting records of the NPO, the financial statements, to understand whether there's an innocent explanation for that. There might very well be, but one wouldn't be able to determine that unless one had access to that level of information. Thank you, Janine. I think I'm not sure if there's a next slide yet. This is a different example of an instance where a person who is known to have been linked to terror activities of terrorist organizations, so who was present in South Africa, was able to use the intervention of an NPO to raise funds, and where those funds were then deposited into the NPO, the non-profit organization's accounts, and were then be able to, from where it was used then to fund the activities of this particular person who was on the radar of the intelligence agencies. And eventually it was determined that this was destined to be used to fund travel to the Levant area where the person would have joined ISIS and would have become part of the ISIS organization. And I think again the ability to raise funds here, the common denominator is the ability to use the fact that an NPO receives funding that was then used not necessarily with the knowledge of the donors to the NPO. To support the activity of the particular person that was on our radar. We can move on. So I think that concludes the short presentation. As I said, this will definitely be shared with members, etc. But and then the point of this is not to make the argument that NPOs are dangerous organizations or that there's a need to clamp down on the control what NPOs does. Or what NPOs do, but certainly to elevate the ability of access to the type of information that is currently already possible to be achieved with the application of the provisions of the NPO Act to categories of NPOs. For those NPOs that are registered and where the information is available through the registration process, through the application of the NPO Act, that makes our lives a lot easier. And as I've said, a large part of the responsibilities on the NPO itself to avoid becoming involved in this type of activity. I would just conclude that one of the comments earlier that was made in our discussion here was to focus specifically on having a registration requirement for NPOs that are linked to listed entities or listed persons under the UN Security Council resolutions, for instance. I think this bears out our comment expecting an NPO also to be in a position to protect itself, because an NPO that is linked to a listed entity is already involved in criminal activity. I think that it's too late to then talk about registering and supervising the activity of such an NPO. What we want is to prevent that from happening and from an NPO becoming involved in the activities, for instance, of listed entities. Thank you, Janine.
Thank you very much, Peter. So I think just one final point. We certainly note the comments, especially by Honorable Swart, about the constitutional aspect, and we will certainly give it further consideration and provide some further submissions in this regard in the next meeting. But our objective is to really try to ensure that we will provide a wording in the legislation that will make it clear, explicitly clear, that the powers, especially of registration, deregistration, and amending to require amendments to the Constitution are very clearly delimited and explicitly cannot be used for taking into consideration or potentially being infringing on the rights to freedom of religion and freedom of association. So that certainly would be our objective, to ensure that certainly those powers are clearly delimited in that manner. So I think that concludes our submissions. Bukili, I don't know if there's any other points you would like to add.
No, thank you, Janine. Happy to pass back to the chair. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I see Honorable Swart wants to make a follow up.
Chair, yes, if I might just engage, and I really appreciate Mr. Smith giving us those examples, which definitely one needs to bear in mind. I think balanced against that is that those are probably very limited. Whilst there's a need to address them, those are very limited case studies, and I'd really appreciate if those documents can also be made available to us. Clearly, there can be abuse in the religious sector and has taken place. What I would like to ask Mr. Smith, given the fact that those NPOs were traced through tracing the financial flows and then brought to the attention, or whether they'd be monitoring, does that not in itself say that the existing provisions are already sufficient? Now, you've said what would make it better or helpful would then you would have access to the constitution and the financial statements of that registered NPO. But does that not contradict your statement as well about the listed entities and that argument, where NPOs that are involved with listed entities already dealing with something illegal? And if you're having an NPO that is intending to deal with illegal matters, they're not going to give you the correct information. The DSD is going to be registered. They will have fake documents, and the DSD's capacity to trace that would be very limited, and that would then fall back on your tracing of financial flows, which you are already doing. So given the fact that you've already, these cases are very important, yes, but very limited in the broader scope of the thousands of NPOs that would need to be registered, is it not an argument to say that the steps that you already have got to trace financial flows are sufficient And even if this is now implemented in terms of a FATF requirement, the likelihood of an entity that intends breaking the law is very profound, and they will probably register false documents. So I'd just like to understand it, but I really appreciate it. It gives me a better understanding of the challenges that you are faced with and the need. The next part I didn't quite follow was your engagement with me on the existing registration. And maybe I don't understand the requirements for existing registration where you register with Companies Act or you register with SARS. Are you saying that that registration would not give you sufficient information, such as the constitution founding documents, which I understand are requirements for such registration? That would be the only argument why you couldn't use that information. My understanding is financial statements, everything must be provided to those documents. I don't see the need then to link it, that there must be an automatic registration as an NPO. If you've got the documentation that you need, as you've just indicated, the documentation which purportedly you would need to follow a terrorist organization or something that must be registered in terms of the NPO, would the registration under those other portals not give you sufficient information, and therefore it would substantiate an argument for a provision that says if you are already registered, you don't need to register in terms of the NPO Act? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Pastor Steve. Peter, do you want to respond to the issue raised by Honorable Chair?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Honorable Swad, I take the point that we were able to identify these instances, and we do not make the claim that there are many such instances. We've been able to identify a few, which to us means that there is something to be concerned about. It certainly is the ability to abuse NPOs in South Africa for this purpose, which we've in the past, in fact, not acknowledged. We've maintained in the past, because we have not come across these instances, that this is something of a phenomenon that authorities might be seeing elsewhere in the world, but it's not materialized in South Africa. We were wrong in that assumption. It has materialized, and in this instance, it was particularly linked to ISIS, for instance, Al-Qaeda, etc. We do not claim that this is a prevalent occurrence, but it is certainly an occurrence that will continue to happen. We were not able to find, we were able to find this not because we had access to information about the NPO. We were able to find these because we had access to the transaction information in other sources. And because of that, the investigative work is turning out to be difficult, to the extent that no prosecutions have been brought forward yet. No, in spite of this information that we've been able to compile, and identify what the trend is that's happening, it's impossible for the investigating and prosecuting authorities at this stage to build a case that can be taken through court. And that, I think, is a point we've made right in the beginning of our discussions when the bill was first introduced. No NPO has ever been charged with activity related to terrorism financing. The point about registration for us is it does give authorities another source of information that in the environment in which we operate with investigating authorities is if there is something that we that prevents investigating authorities from achieving the links that they need to make and finding the evidence to that, then it's something that we need to consider and find a solution if it's possible. But I think the broader problem that we're trying to solve here is, before we get to the stage of an investigation, to create an environment in which we can prevent NPOs from being exploited in this way, and in which there is a form of oversight and requirements for NPOs to meet that enable NPOs themselves to avoid this becoming involved in this situation where investigating authorities might be interested in following that the what happens with their donations or where the funds are destined to go. The provisions of the NPO Act contain those type of safeguards. Those safeguards are not in the Companies Act and they're not in the Trust Property Control Act. The incorporation, memorandum of incorporation may or may not include the type of clauses that a constitution of an NPO should include. The same with the trust instrument that sets up a charitable trust. But if an NPO is set up to meet the requirements of the NPO Act, we have certainty that the NPO's constitution will contain those particular clauses, that there will be a particular standard for its office bearers. And those are not things that can be enforced under the Companies Act or under the Trust Property Control Act or under the tax legislation. Moreover, that the companies, the CIPC, cannot supervise whether office bearers of an NPO, for instance, meet those standards. Well, neither can the master of the High Court or the SARS. It is for us to add this part of the framework that operates at the preventive level and that enables investigations should that be necessary. It does not take away from the fact that more work needs to be done also on the investigative side, capacity, better financial investigating skills, etc. And those need to be reserved for those instances where an abuse has happened. I think that the message that we're trying to convey is that this needs to be built on a framework that starts off with good governance and a good base for NPOs to operate from. And that determines the success for the rest of the framework to work and where in those instances where it's it then is required to investigate and prosecute, that can be done. But we would want to avoid to get even to that stage. Listed entities are already identified at the international level by the UN Security Council as entities that are associated with the activities of Al-Qaeda or ISIS. So those are very specific entities, not generally terrorist organizations, but two very specific organizations. And certainly when an NPO is associated with those entities that are linked to Al-Qaeda or ISIS, then that NPO, South Africa's obligation would and then actually be to prosecute that NPO and to make a petition to the Security Council to also list that NPO, because that NPO would then be similarly associated with ISIS or Al-Qaeda. But there's a broader range of activities. We have other terrorist organizations operating on our continent. We have Al-Shabaab in the eastern African parts, and we have terrorist organizations operating in other parts that are not listed by the UN Security Council, where we don't have that level of association. But in those cases, we are equally required to protect our own community from exploitation. Thank you, Janine. Mr. Swada, I've answered as best as I can. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Honorable Swada, you want to make a follow-up?
Chair, I really find this very, very important, and I hope you'll indulge me because I really appreciate Mr. Smith's responses. But can I just ask him again, the issue firstly of the danger of false registration of NPOs and the coming back to what the NPO sector said, we know that many NPOs already non-compliant of 150 odd thousand NPOs. We know that the Department of Social Development does not have the capacity. I appreciate that there will be some limited additional capacity, but what the minister was referring to was mainly capacity to be given to the Hawks, the SIU, the NPA Asset Forfeiture Unit, they are at the front of the queue. I know social development, if they get more money, they want to empower social workers. So it will be limited funds that will be coming through. Is your danger not that you're entrusting a very significant and very necessary issue of fighting terrorism and money laundering, which highly likely will not be able to be implemented given the incapacity of social development, given the fact that there's an estimated 150,000 NPOs that would have to be registered and then monitored? In other words, not the financial flows, but monitored as far as what you've just indicated, the implementation of the constitution, the office bearers, that would be the role then of this directorate. And quite frankly, I have great doubts as to whether it's going to help you with achieving what you want to achieve, and that is fighting terrorism funding and money laundering, given the fact of the capacity constraints and given the fact that there are, as some of the NGOs pointed out, there are concerns. For example, let me just give you the example. During the lockdown, the department was taken to court for refusing NGOs, MPOs, to deliver food parcels. And a high court matter, a high court judgment had to be obtained against the department to enable NGOs to give out food parcels. How ridiculous is that? So you don't have to comment on that example, but is the critical question not that, is this not, and I hesitate to say this because I really appreciate your genuineness to address the FATF requirements, but is this not a tick box exercise that cannot be practically implemented given the severe constraints facing the Department of Social Development? And will you not pick up further problems when it comes to an evaluation, a mutual evaluation by FATF, when they're saying, well, this is the law that's now been passed. How many have been monitored? How many have been registered? And is this an effective tool? These are difficult questions. These are really difficult questions, but it's incumbent upon us as MPs to ask these questions. The chairperson refers to me as a pastor. I really appreciate that. I'm not as such a pastor. I'm actually a lawyer, a parliamentarian, but I am a believer, and so I do appreciate the religious concerns as well. But these are issues I think we're all trying to grapple with and to find a solution to help us avoid the grey listing. So that is my intention with these questions. We really want to assist National Treasury as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Akbar Swart. I think let's move to the next item. If honorable members are done with the clarity seeking questions and comments, let's outline the next process. Let me appreciate the submissions from stakeholders, of which the submissions have been thoroughly responded to by Treasury and FIC. Those submissions and responses from Treasury will be considered by the committee when we process the bill next week on the 1st of November. And we really appreciate this exercise is not conducted so that we tick the boxes in terms of the checklist that we have had oral and written submissions. However, is to make sure that there is meaningful participation by the public in the lawmaking. That's how the public participation model is crafted, that those who are affected by a particular decision or law should be given ample time to make submissions orally and in a written form. And that kind of submission really should be meaningful. Hence, we have dedicated this period in two occasions. You remember, we first had the first round of submissions, and we agreed that the time was not enough for stakeholders to make meaningful submissions. And we extended until the 25th of October. And in between, Treasury was able to engage some of the stakeholders which raised issues with them or who have requested bilaterals. So from here, we'll request Treasury to submit all the responses to the committee the latest Monday afternoon, because the following day, which is Tuesday, the 1st of November, we are going to consider what we call clause by clause processing of the bill and adopt the report, which will have to be submitted to the National Assembly. We have heard about the issue that has been raised about the DSD and its regulatory powers on the NPOs. It's a matter that the committee will note, but remember that Treasury has got limitations to respond on the competency of another department because they are not a super department. It is for us as MPs to say that the stakeholders are raising the issue of the capacity of the directorate responsible for NPOs and raise it with our colleagues in the committee, the portfolio committee responsible for DSD, that something has to be done in that regard. Remember, the allocation of functions and powers to departments and SOEs is the competency of the president. So it can only be the president who can take away those powers from DSD to another department. But for now, let's understand that the powers of regulating the NPOs are with DSD. So we'll take it upon ourselves as the MPs to raise the matter with our colleagues in the other committee responsible. Thanks very much, honorable members, stakeholders, the media. Let's meet again next week, Tuesday. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Chair.
Pleasure.